This is the 12th lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, hosted by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dharmaram Institute of Liberal Art in Taiwan. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Venerable Champasidran, who is going to talk to us on the topic of gender construction. Functions and gender relations from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. Champasidran got her PhD in 2009 from the University of Hamburg's Department of India and Tibet, with a dissertation on Redmapa, Buddhist Yogic scholar of the 14th century, the forgotten revival of Madhyamaka philosophy in Tibet. Since 2010, she is a principal investigator on the ordination of nuns in the Tibetan Buddhist canon and its presentation in Tibetan commentaries at the University of Hamburg, funded by the Deutsche Forschungsgemeinschaft, DFG. She has a visiting professorship at the Academy of World Religion of Hamburg in 2012. Since 2013, she is a full-time postdoc research fellow at the Academy of World Religions, University of Hamburg, Project Religion and Dialogue in Modern Societies, funded by the German Federal Ministry for Education and Research in BMBF. And with that short introduction, now I hand over to Champasidran.
Yeah, thank you very much. First of all, my thanks to the Venerable Bante Analayo for his invitation on behalf of the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies and the Dharmadram Institute of Liberal Arts. Since the 2007 Hamburg International Congress on Buddhist Women's Role in the Sangha, for almost 10 years, Bante devoted large parts of his time to support the Bhikshuni movement through his academic publications. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank you very much for this. Thank you, Bante. This is really, may all the Dharma flourish by your efforts. In addition to Bante's introduction, I would like to state that I also studied Sanskrit and Pali, and since I'm working in the Academy of World Religions, that means my approach to discuss gender constructions and gender relations is an interdisciplinary one and could be regarded as the one of a Buddhist, feminist, or queer theologian. So even if the focus today lays on Tibetan Buddhism, I will not limit myself to these sources, but consider what I call the three mainstream traditions of Buddhism. So what is the aim of my lecture? My lecture will show how the female gender for centuries is being put into question and newly constructed, and how the attitude towards women is ambivalent or ambitious till today, how the Buddha organized Buddhist communities and its impact on gender relations, how for centuries hierarchization and exclusion took place, how the understanding of emptiness, shunyata, and the view of non-duality can have a major impact on the construction of gender, and how the understanding of tantric meditation practice derives from androgyny. I will argue that around the year 2000, we have reached a crucial point, and thus Tara, a female Buddha, and the notion of a queer Buddha, as Susan Mosig is presenting it, have become very important. By the three mainstream traditions, I mean the three living traditions of Buddhism we find today. Here you can see a map of the spread of Buddhism. I will not go into the details now, but we have Theravada Buddhism, East Asian Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism we find in Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and parts of Vietnam. And East Asian Buddhism, widely referred to as Mahayana or Paramitayana, including Zen, Pure Land, etc., we find in Vietnam, Korea, Japan, China, Taiwan, and then Tibetan Buddhism, including Vajrayana Buddhism, is considered a later school of Mahayana, which we find in Tibet, Bhutan, Sikkim, Nepal, the Indian Himalayan region, southern Russia, and Mongolia. Before I start my talk, let me give an overview what to expect the next maybe 45 to 60 minutes. I will try to keep myself brief so that we have some possibility for discussion in the end. I have five key points I want to address. First, the state of research and discussion. Second, the reflections on gender constructions and gender relations in Buddhism, and in this context I will also address the binary sex system, ambivalent attitude toward LGBTQ, subordination of women and exclusion of those who do not fit into this binary system. Then the key point three will be ultimately everything is empty, are gender specific differences really insignificant? And number four, can women become a Buddha, the Buddha a man or queer? And number five, androgyny, the unification of masculine and feminine traits in each person. So I come to my first point, state of research and discussion. Rita Gross is convinced that Buddhism is sexist but not irreparable. Similarly to Christian and Jewish feminist theologians, Gross argues that since the fundamental teaching and symbols of Buddhism are essentially egalitarian and liberating, Buddhism is actually reconstructible. The teaching of the Buddha is equally relevant for and applicable to all beings. In her view, Christian feminist thought is far more developed than its Buddhist counterpart. The questions faced and most strategies employed are very similar. In order to bring together Buddhism and feminism, she developed a simple and clear Buddhist definition of feminism, that is, the radical practice of the co-humanity of women and men. Buddhist feminist theology has to be just, and like feminism, in order to lead to true transformation, it needs to become an ongoing practice of changing one's language, expectations, and ideas. Thus, Buddhism has just to be true to itself. So, in summary, we can say if we take Buddhism seriously, actually there should be no gender discrimination. I have to go back one slide I missed. I wanted to start with more general about religion and gender. Sorry for the confusion. Gender is historically, socially, and religiously constructed in different ways. The role and image of the sexes in the different cultures vary wildly and are continually subjected to change. There exists Ursula King calls a double blindness. That means humanities, social, and natural sciences are blind with regard to religion, and sciences of religions are blind with regard to gender. So religion and gender are not stable but trans-historical categories. Often, however, they are regarded as part of a natural order, normatively specified by the sacred texts. So the roles of men and women, sometimes we hear from, especially when you are in the interfaith dialogue, just recently when I went to the Council of Europe, one of the theologians there mentioned that roles of men and women are not indefinitely interchangeable. So there is the question whether there is something that the nature of men and women is completely different and how it differs. And so this is a extended discussion within the different theologies. It would be interesting to learn more about this within the Buddhist tradition. So what I can say here, coming from the research I have taken note of so far is that religion and gender are not stable but transhistorical categories. Often, however, they are regarded as patients. So even if we accept that from the point of physical existence, there are differences between men and women, the question is whether there's any difference when it comes to spirituality or religious, to the religion and spiritual growth and our striving for liberation. Since the late 20th century, feminism aims to create an awareness of women's full humanness. Others argue that concepts such as women's subjectivity and equality are rooted in Western way of thinking and must be relativized according to culture and religion. So there is a tension between the different views on this. As I mentioned already, Rita Gross argues that since the fundamental teachings and symbols of Buddhism are essentially egalitarian and liberating, Buddhism is reconstructible. While Elizabeth Harris, for example, states that through the lens of gender studies, there's clearly a need to rediscover women's histories, to reinterpret holy texts, to campaign for equal rights, to explore the nature of consciousness and the construction of identity, and to affirm the body, especially this letter, to explore the nature of consciousness and the construction of identity and affirming the body. These are the discussions that derive from the question whether there is a difference when it comes to the spiritual growth of men and women within the religion, whether there is a difference of men and women or not, and what is the difference or is not the difference. And Reiko Onuma, she stresses that a sense of separation and complementarity of the two genders is pervasive throughout early Buddhist literature. We will hear on this more later. So let me see. The next sheet. Yeah, another important research to be considered is that of Alan Sponberg, especially his hermeneutical considerations of the four distinct attitudes towards women and the feminine are, in my view, very important. Soteriological inclusion refers to the inclusion of women with regard to salvation. Women as well as men can gain ahatship or liberation, or in other words, nirvana, the cessation of suffering. Institutional androcentrism means that institutionally and in decision-making relevant contexts, the structures are dictated and dominated by men. Women may follow their vocation as a nun, but only within a carefully regulated institutional structure which safeguards and reaffirms the social standards of male authority and female subordination. Here it is important to note that the Buddha himself has introduced the possibility of full ordination, upasampada, for women as well as for men. This is the highest consecration in the context of monastic communities. Since the 1970s, there is a worldwide movement to revive full or higher ordination for Buddhist nuns. I really hope that this will not only further equal opportunities and religious equality for women, but also promote the appreciation of the role of women in the society as a whole. Thus, it would help to improve the human rights situation in terms of gender equality for most of Asia. I had given you for preparation my article on this issue, so no need to go into this here further. And then the fourth, ascetic misogyny, relates to the individual, not to the institutional level. It's about men's fear of the feminine. A man may fear, for example, that a woman could endanger his chaste lifestyle as a monk. Such fear often manifests itself in some extremely women-hostile statements. Rather than realizing that the causes for desire lie in one's own mind, they are projected in and identified with the object of desire, and this are the women. From a gender perspective, soteriological androgyny seems to be the most interesting category because it takes into account gender difference and has the potential to produce equality. Buddhahood is understood as a symbol of the union of male and female characteristic traits. I will come back to this later. I agree with Sponberg when he states with regard to Buddhist literature, we have a rich multivocality, not a simple, inconsistent ambivalence. Rather than seeking a doctrinal reconciliation or justification for this inconsistency of views in the literature, instead we must seek to understand the social and intellectual dynamics of the early community of Buddhists that led to such a discordant juxtaposition of views. Next, I come to my second key point, reflections on gender constructions and gender relations from a Tibetan Buddhist perspective. In this section, I want to raise three central questions. Number one, are there any statements about sex or gender in the early Buddhist texts at all? And if so, which and how many sexes does Buddhism acknowledge? Second, do classical Buddhist texts make a distinction between biological and social gender? And number three, what is the impact of such a categorization on Buddhist attitudes towards LGBTQ, subordination of women, and exclusion of those who do not fit into the binary system? My reflections are rooted in the Tibetan Buddhist self-understanding. The self-understanding of Tibetan Buddhism can be compared to the rungs of a ladder. The foundation of our practice is the Shravakayana. On this basis, one may practice the common Mahayana or Paramitayana, while Vajrayana is understood as a teaching only for advanced practitioners. Thus, Tibetan Buddhism tends to be inclusive, but also tends to go with some claim for superiority, which for sure I do not share. So then we come to the next. In principle, the Buddhist community is organized as two-sex system. The Abhidhamma Kosha, written by Vasubandhu in the 4th, 5th century, contains a list of 22 faculties in Sanskrit Indriya. Among them are femininity and masculinity. Thus, a distinction is made between female and male sex or sex characteristic. Both fall into the category bhava with a long A. In Sanskrit, according to Monier Williams, bhava stems from bhu and also means becoming, being, existing, occurring, appearance. From a gender perspective, the latter, a more dynamic understanding of the term, would be better than as nature, which seems to imply that gender is something fixed which cannot change. A third gender is not given in this context. Vasubandhu explains in the Abhidhamma Kosha Bhashya that due to these two faculties, beings from the two categories of male and female, and that they differ with regard to physical form, voice, and manner of being. With regard to manner of being, Buddha Gosa explains in the Atta Salini that boys' games are not the same as girls' games. Thus, Buddhism obviously attributes certain gender stereotype behaviors to biological sex. As I said, until today, the Buddhist community is uniformly organized as two-sex system, although exceptions are discussed. I'll come back to this later. Originally, the Buddhist community consisted of four assemblies, as it is still or again the case in some places today. These four assemblies or discipleships, Chatush Parishat, are monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. That is the basic social hierarchical structure until today, at least in theory. The Buddha founded an order of nuns, but soon it was subordinated to the order of monks. Nevertheless, a principal subordination of women was not intended because laymen are allowed to bow to nuns. Nevertheless, gender definitely plays a role and leads to the segregation of the sexes. For the admission into the order, the Vinaya prescribes a clear identification either as a woman or as a man. Monks and nuns live separately, and in joint ceremonies, not only in religious ones, men and women sit separately from each other. Yet in Theravada, as well as in Tibetan Buddhism, fully ordained nuns somehow got lost, and the highest religious leadership positions are currently exclusively filled by men. Unlike the time of the Buddha, when women, perhaps similar to the female apostle in the Jesus movement, used to play important roles. At the end of the discourse of the Chatushparishad Sutra, for example, the Buddha sent out these four assemblies to spread his teaching for the well-being and the happiness of divine and human beings. In this context, I like to clarify some widespread misunderstandings. In Tibetan Buddhism, women can become teachers, nuns, or yoginis, while either living in partnership, having a family, or living as a nun in a female religious order, or living as a hermit in reclusion in a cave or in any other secluded area. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we do have female lamas like His Eminency Sakya Jetsen Chimi Luding, who is a lama and a upasika, and His Eminency Mindraling Jetsen Khandru Rinpoche, who is a lama and a shramanerika. So here we need to understand, you can see that on the picture, that Her Eminence Sakya Jetsen Chimi Luding, she's also wearing a kind of robe, the red robe, but she has long hair and she's wearing sleeves. So this means she's not a nun, but she is a lay woman, and she has a family, she has children, but still she is considered to be a lama, while His Eminence Mindraling Jetsen Khandru Rinpoche, she is shramanerika, a novice nun, but also considered to be a lama. So this is no problem, and this has always existed in the Tibetan history. There are not so many of them, but you find them, and one just needs to understand that the term lama does not necessarily that somebody is ordained in the sense of the Vinaya as a monk or nun. So sometimes you hear this notion that in the Tibetan tradition, monks can marry, and this is actually, at least for the part of Tibetan Buddhism I have studied for the last 35 years, not the case. So being a lama is, we may have some exception, as Alexander von Rosbart has shown in Nepal. There indeed we have such kind of phenomena, but this doesn't belong to Tibetan Buddhism. This is Nevara Buddhism. So then in history, we did have some bhikshunis who were lamas and who were also highly realized yoginis like Samding Dorje Pakmo. His Holiness the Dalai Lama in his autobiography mentions an encounter with the 12th reincarnation of the Tibetan saint Samding Dorje Pakmo. This saint lived in the 15th century and was born as Princess Chöki Drönme of Gungtang. She received a higher ordination, Upasampada, as a nun by monks alone. And at the same time, she was considered to be a highly realized yogini. She is the only nun known to us who headed a monastery for monks, the Samding Monastery in central Tibet. But for sure, similar to His Holiness Sakya Trinzen, the head of the Sakya tradition, when a lay person is considered to be the head of a monastery, or a bhikshuni is considered to be the head of the monastery, this doesn't count for the Vinaya rituals. So whenever there is something that needs to be done, like ordination and so on, instruction on Vinaya, then there are others in the monasteries who are taking over this function. This also needs to be understood. So now let us come back to the Buddhist community based on the two-sex system, and let's take a look to the situation of women at the time of the Buddha. Women had in many respects, at least as nuns, equal opportunities as men to go their way to liberation. In Tibetan Buddhism, we believe in rebirth, and this means we believe in the mind stream that continues from life to life. The nature of mind remains always the same until enlightenment. What changes is the body. Rebirth takes place as male or as female or as LGBTQ. No distinction is made in the mind training in regard to how to practice as a woman or as a man, and we just concentrate on the precious human rebirth and how to use the precious human rebirth to lead a meaningful life. A particular passage in the Vinaya clearly shows that there is no essential difference between men and women. It is a regulation how to proceed in case of natural sex change, what to do when a monk suddenly becomes a woman or vice versa, in other words, what to do when the biological sex changes. Has the person to be newly ordained or does the ordination remain valid? The Buddha decided that a reordination is not necessary. The person is simply transferred to the other community and from now on has to keep the slightly different rules of the opposite sex. But the vow, Tibetan Dompa or Sanskrit Samvara, whether man or woman, is the same. Although there is no essential difference between men and women, the biological sex, however, is significant too. There are situations that prescribe to make sure that the person has the right sex. Again, our source is the Vinaya. In the Mulasavastivada ordination manual for women, it is described how nuns should assure themselves of the correctness of the sexual characteristic of a new candidate. When bathing and dressing, they should have a look whether it is indeed a woman who has asked for admission into the order. In addition, there is a list of impediments to ordination on the basis of which it has to be clarified whether anything presents an obstacle for ordination. The very first question is, are you a woman? And the candidate responds, I'm a woman. If she is not, you can't continue with the ritual. Other questions follow and indicate that cases of hermaphrodism, that is having two sexes as well as asexuality in the sense of complete absence of sex characteristics, rule out the possibility of ordination. Homosexuality, however, is no impediment to ordination. The monastic lifestyle, anyway, requires a life of complete sexual abstinence. Nevertheless, for lay people, with regard to homosexuality, considering the cultural context of ancient India, one of the lay precepts, how to refrain from sexual misconduct, has to be interpreted contextually in line with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights today. Another question in this context is how to deal with the third gender. As already mentioned, if the sex is not distinct, one can neither become a monk or a nun, and is thus de facto excluded from this path towards salvation. I have no information whether such exclusion matches with the social realities in the various traditions today. In particular, from Thailand, we hear about monastic orders with transsexual monks, so-called ladyboys, having the third sex. At a Vinaya conference in Sarnath, a Theravada monk asked whether this is also a problem in the Tibetan tradition, but there was no response. But anyway, asking whether there's also a problem with this in the Tibetan tradition implies that third gender people have been admitted to the order there. So, but this would need some field research in this field to find out. So we have seen that in some way sex or gender matters. How does this spiritually go along the Mahayana teachings of emptiness, shunyata, a term common to East Asian as well as Tibetan Buddhism? There are several Buddhist texts about the teaching of no self, anatma, that present gender differences as irrelevant and ultimately insignificant. Thus, gender is differently constructed or deconstructed. They state that the terms man and woman are just a designation. Here perhaps we can draw a parallel to the deconstructivistic approach of Judith Butler and her reading of speech act theory. In her understanding, social and biological gender are performative. Gender is only real to the extent that it is performed. From a Tibetan Buddhist perspective, one understanding of dependent arising, pratityasamutpada, is that everything exists on mere designation. That is, things merely exist dependently in terms of or in relation to verbal and mental labeling. Although the term shunyata, emptiness, may not occur in the Pali canon, the idea seems to be rooted in early Buddhist literature. This is the way I read and understand the story of the nun Soma, who settled at the foot of a tree for meditation. Mara, the evil, tries to convince her that women have only a two-finger wisdom, but Soma drives him away, sharply retorting that Mara could harm only those who think I am a woman, or I am a man, or I am anything at all. This implies that she has attained the path of seeing, Darshanamaga, and realized that ultimately everything is empty. Nevertheless, one has to be aware that the notion of emptiness can easily lead to misuse when wrongly understood as nullifying conventional realities. Conventionally, gender does exist and matters. One should not use the tainted teaching of no self, of anatma, to make women believe that they are bad practitioners if they become socially engaged for gender equality, but encourage them to fight for it skillfully. In the Mahayana exists the idea that wisdom, prajna, the insight into ultimate reality, and skillful means, upaya, have to go hand in hand. This idea has been further shaped and deepened and seems to have opened the door for a new understanding of Buddhahood. With the advent of the early Mahayana sutras about the first century, before we said AD, but according to the study and articles of Uwe Hartmann, I think we can now say in general BC, a shift in regard to the aim of salvation can be observed. The Mahayana propagates the path of bodhisattvas who strive for Buddhahood. This leads to the question whether women too can attain enlightenment in terms of perfect Buddhahood. A number of Mahayana sutras teach that by virtue of spiritual attainment, a female bodhisattva must change gender in order to achieve Buddhahood. Otherwise, she cannot obtain Buddhahood in this life. We can find this discussed in Diana Powell, 1979, but there is also some more recent research on this by the Venerable Dhammadina, I think with the Journal of Buddhist Ethics you can download there. According to other Mahayana sutras, such gender transformation or change of sex is unnecessary. The Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra makes in a very humorous way somehow fun about the self-importance of some monks, and it enjoys particular popularity. You will be familiar with it. Thus, multivocality with regard to the female body becomes, again here also in the corpus of Mahayana literature, obvious. And in this context, I feel it's also interesting to see that the notion of gender transformation is not exclusively to the Mahayana literature, but can already be found in the Vinaya. And we had upload a text on this from the Pali Vinaya, compiled by Petra Kiefer-Pühls, which you can still find on the Congress on Buddhist Women's website if you want to read it. We have also identified the respective source in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, but that's not online yet. Now I come to my hero, Tara, the liberator, a female Buddha. So I think what is special about the Tara, I mean, it's quite late. I don't know whether one could still consider it early Buddhism or not. I mean, from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, I think Tibetans themselves or traditional Tibetan lamas would consider it to be the word of the Buddha. The Tara Tantra is part of the Kangyur, of the words of the Buddha in the Tibetan Buddhist Tripitaka, and it is considered early. From a historical critical point of view, I wouldn't share this. Anyway, the point here is that quite early, I mean in the 6th, 7th century, we have Tara, and this Tara Tantra came together with Atisha in the 11th century to Tibet. And what I really personally like about Tara is that she became enlightened in the body of a woman. So there is this story going along with this practice of Tara. In the Golden Rosary by Taranatha, explained that Tara is—it's a legend, but a nice one. Tara, she had in a previous life, so it's constructed similar to the Jatakas. In a previous life, before she became a Buddha, she was a princess with the name Yeshudava, moon of wisdom. And she made very good progress on her spiritual path. And the monks who were around her at a certain point suggested to her that because of the huge amount of merit, religious merit she has made, she should make a dedication of all these merit to become reborn as a man. And at this point, Yeshudava, she laughed, and similar to Soma, in a way, said that there is no such distinction between men and women, and that actually there are so many who have attained Buddhahood in the body of a man, but she will show that one can achieve this in the body of a woman. And therefore, she made a pledge, a promise, that from now on, until she receives Samyaksambuddha, she will practice as a woman in the body of a woman and show that this is possible. So this is a very good role model we have in Buddhism for women if they are searching for role models to inspire them on their way. And I mean, in this connection, there is this discussion whether the Buddha is a man or not. And I mean, when trained in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, I mean, I became a nun in 1981, and the first 15 years before I embarked on an academic training, I got traditional training with a Tibetan Geshe, Geshe Thupten Ngawang, at the Tibetan Center in Hamburg. And I remember when he was correcting me, saying, well, this is not possible. You cannot refer to the Buddha as man or woman, because this terminology belongs to those who are in samsara, not to those who have reached the path of seeing and have become ayas. So saints, you cannot refer to the Buddha as a man or as a woman. And there is this discussion of the 32 characteristics of a man, which Bhikkhu Analayo has shown is reaching back to a pre-Buddhist time. And so actually, I think he's going to come out with another publication next year on this topic, so he will know much better than me on this issue. But I feel that it's clear from what I have seen so far that these are the 32 characteristics that were ascribed to a Chakravartin in the Indian ancient culture. And somehow these have also been ascribed to the Buddha. So there seems to be some room for negotiation if we consider the social and historical context, that this is something that needs to be interpreted and has to be seen on that background. So what I feel is very interesting that Susan Mrozik, it's an article I came along with recently, she argues even that the Buddha is omnibodied, omnisexed, and omnigendered. And she reads intentionally against the sexist discourse of a narrative concerning the previous birth of the historical Buddha Shakyamuni, rethinking it in Butler's terms, what kind of body matter? So, I mean, this is really a paper I can only recommend if you haven't read it yet. I mean, where the only one I have seen so far that really in very much detail deals with Judith Butler's approach, with who is the leading expert on gender issues in Western gender studies, and trying to get it together with a text that is early, quite early, and I think does not only belong to the Mahayana literature, but really to the early Buddhist literature. And she speaks about a queer Buddha, differently abled Buddha, low caste or Dalit Buddha, blue color Buddha, black Buddha, Latino or Latina Buddha. The question is not whether and how such Buddhas exist. The question is whether and how such Buddhas or Bodhisattvas attain symbolic legitimacy and intelligibility. Buddhist tradition values difference as much as it values the transcendence of difference. So, next, I just see here what Bhikkhu Analayo says. There's so much written now. Bhikkhu Analayo, thank you for the kind words. But there's no need for discussion, but I need to go ahead. Smiley, and then certainly not early Buddhism. What was this referring to? I don't know what he said now. Bhikkhu Analayo, the 32 marks are generally gender neutral. Some are masculine, but several others are feminine. Overall, pace, powers, the impression is of androgyny. Well, anyway, one of the 32 marks is a male organ, so I think we have to go deeper into this terminology and find out what it's really referring to. Bhikkhuni, Dhammadina, powers, John, a ball of a man, images of masculinity, sex, and the body of any woman. Yes, this is one of the, he was on our gender panel in Vienna, and he was talking about it, wondering why nobody has taken it up so far, and I think Venerable Anayalo may take it up. Just giving the reference to Power's book referred to by Venerable Analayo. Yes, thank you. And Bhikkhu Analayo to Tara. There's so much. Sorry, I haven't seen this. Now it gets... the point is not that the Buddha was not a man, but that the image is not one of masculinity, and the nature of the Buddha's private parts, I argue, is about being able to retract it. Well, this we can maybe discuss at the end. Looking forward to hearing more about this. So I try to shift over to my fifth key point, androgyny. Buddhahood is understood as the unification of masculine and feminine traits in each person. As mentioned in the beginning, from a gender perspective, soteriological androgyny seems to be the most interesting category because it takes into account gender difference and has the potential to produce equality. Buddhahood is understood as a symbol of the union of male and female characteristic traits. Nevertheless, the mother of all Buddhas is considered to be female, but let me say this before I come to the next sheet. I mean, when you see this tantric depiction of a male Buddha in unification with a female Buddha, as you find it only in the Vajrayana tradition, as especially in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I mean, when you receive, for example, like me as a Buddhist nun, an initiation in such higher yoga tantra practice, then you are instructed to meditate that you are having both of, you are this whole thing, what you see on the picture. I mean, you are the male part and you are the female part. So it's really, I mean, taken on this level of meditation only, at least in the Tibetan Gelugpa tradition. And it is really that you yourself imagine to be both the male and the female deity. And, but as I mentioned, the mother of all Buddhas is considered to be female. Prajnaparamita is worshipped as the mother of all Buddhas. Like Tara in Tibetan Buddhism, she is referred to as Chomlen Dema Bhagavati. So this is the female form of Bhagavan. She is considered to be a fully enlightened Buddha. But for sure, within the three Kaya theory, she is not Nirmana Kaya, but Sambhoga Kaya. As Raiko Onuma points out, the tendency toward androgyny and gender equality in matters of the Dharma must be balanced. Since prajna is a feminine noun, wisdom itself is also seen as a feminine quality and is often paired with a masculine quality equally necessary for the attainment of Buddhahood, compassionate, skillful means of upaya, which is a masculine noun. The attainment of Buddhahood is then envisioned symbolically as the union of male and female forces, whose complementarity and independence are emphasized. This type of gender symbolism becomes significantly more pronounced, however, with the advent of Tantra. And here, women can attain full enlightenment in this lifetime. I mean, Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Tibetan Gelug tradition, based on several cycles of tantras, such as the Guhyasamaja Tantra, the Chakrasambhara Tantra, and the Hevajra Tantra, emphasizes that women can attain full enlightenment in this lifetime. This is in detail discussed by Yale Benta in a recent publication, 2015. So now I come to my conclusion. In sum, as mentioned in the beginning, through the lens of gender studies, there is clearly a need to rediscover women's histories, to foster feminist analysis and reconstruction, to reinterpret or reread the authoritative texts, to consider equal opportunities for women, to explore the nature of consciousness, to better understand the construction of male and female identity, to affirm and appreciate the female body, to make the female more visible, and to strengthen acting in history, as many Buddhists tend to do. We should instead understand them as narrative texts, as a myth. In order to remain relevant for today's societies, the texts need to be seen against their contextual background and interpreted according to their textual as well as to their social, historical, and cultural context before being applied to our time and situation. The question we have to ask ourselves is, and this I learned from Judaism, what can the text tell me? It's not so much about what does the text tell? What does it mean at that time of the Buddha? This is a different question, which for sure historical critical study does enlarge. But the point is, we want to keep the text relevant for today. So we have to ask, what can the text tell me, a contemporary follower of the Buddha? To get the answer, we have to filter the essence. Buddhist principles such as dependent arising, non-violence, to avoid suffering and to practice love and compassion should lead our way and enable Buddhists to reconstruct what is missing, neglect what is obsolete, and clarify what could lead to misunderstanding, and it would help to promote freedom from gender roles, gender stereotypes, and oppression. Thank you very much for your attention.
So now I see again what Bhikkhu Anala just said here. The other point was that Tara is not early. Yes, I guess from your point of view, 6th, 7th century is definitely not early Buddhism. This I can understand. I just wanted to make sure that from Tibetan Buddhist self-understanding, this we always need to consider too, whether it's a historical fact or not. I agree with you, it's not. But for them, I mean, it is quite early because Buddhism became only transmitted to Tibet starting from the 7th, 8th century, as I had shown on my map in the beginning. So for them, still 6th, 7th century in ancient India appears to be early. So it's also relative and depends on the person. Bhikkhu Nidamadina, thanks very much to you. And Bhikkhu Anala, yet we would call that middle period. That's interesting. I mean, can you tell me, I mean, I was actually searching for it. I remember, I mean, I have to be careful. I don't say the name, but I remember I had asked one scholar, what do we really mean by early Buddhism? And this scholar said to me, well, I would say until Abhidhamma Kosha Vasubandhu, this time we could consider to be early. But then I think there's another discussion that seems to say it's more the Nikayas are early Buddhism. Or can you explain a bit on this? Or is this not the right place to say this? I mean, it would be interesting for me. Middle period usually is considered to end with the closure of the reduction of the Vinayas and the formation of Mahayana sutras. There can be some difference, but I would use the term early Buddhism for the period up to Ashoka. Interesting, so different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it seems that there are, I don't know how we are doing it, you know, when we are in this manuscript projects here in Hamburg with this huge manuscript project. I mean, I think it's also considered to be very early Buddhist manuscripts. There can be some differences, but I would use Dhammadina usually up to 5th century. This mentioned the term was defined like that by Schopen. Yeah, this is what I had heard from this one scholar. This would be around the time of Abhidhamma Kosha. Mm-hmm. Proto-Vajrayana is normally not considered part of middle period. Mm. Okay. Yeah, thank you. That's very interesting. So is there anything from your side? Sorry that I missed the possibility to be available at the today afternoon, but we had some technical problem. We tried for hours, and now we finally made it. The dates we discuss refer to the arising of ideas, not to manuscripts, which of course will be later. Yeah. Hmm. Ah, yeah. Okay, this is also important to make this distinction. Yeah, you're right. Sri Lankan palm leaf manuscripts of the 19th century could still contain Buddhist texts. Yeah, but difficult to prove, isn't it? I mean, I believe in the southern part, manuscripts are much more difficult to keep because of the weather than, and the climate than in the northern part. There were fully fledged Mahayana communities already in the middle period. Well, I just remember, you know, this talk Jens Uwe Hartmann was giving here in Hamburg some time back when, in relation to the Banyan statues in Afghanistan, they had this new findings, and he said that this has completely changed the present stand of our knowledge because due to this new ways of, sorry, I lack the vocabulary to this new ways of how to find technical possibilities to find out from which time the manuscripts stem. They can say that these very early Mahayana texts found there have to be dated about 1st or 2nd century BC. So this is, I mean, this would mean that it was already, there must have been some Mahayana communities at that time already. So it depends on communities, texts and areas. Yes. Ah, yeah, genau, this radiocarbon dating. Thank you. Okay. Yeah, how are we with regard to time? It's only 1 hour, so because we don't have so many people attending, I was hoping we have more time for discussion, but there are no questions. Yes, there are no questions. So then we can finish. Then I thank you very much for inviting me and hope that this lecture will be of some benefit and apologize for all shortcomings and looking forward to contact me also by email if you have any question. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.